We had better luck with trees and casks. For while the Vronovout had been busy creating the library grape, their fraws and sewers a few miles up the valley at the rustic math of Upper Vrone Forest had been at similar pains with the trees that were traditionally fashioned into casks. The cells of the Vrone Oak's heartwood, still half alive even after the tree had been chopped down, sliced into staves, and bound into a cask, sampled the molecules drifting around in the wine, releasing some, making others percolate outward until they precipitated on the outside of the cask as fragrant sheens, rinds, and incrustations. This wood was as choosy about the conditions under which it was stored as the library grape was about weather and soil. So a winemaker who treated the casks poorly and didn't provide them with the stimulation they liked would be punished by finding them crusted and oozing with all the most desirable resins, sugars, and tannins, with nothing left on the inside of the cask but cleaning solvent. The wood liked the same range of temperature and humidity as humans, and its cellular structure was responsive to vibrations. The casks, like musical instruments, resonated in sympathy with the human voice, and so wine that had been stored in a vault used for choir rehearsals would taste different from that stashed along the walls of a dining room. The climate at St. Edhar's was well suited to growing Vrone Oaks. Better yet, we were somewhat renowned for our prowess with aging. Casks felt comfortable in our refectory and our minster, and responded warmly to all the talking and singing. Less fortunate consents shipped their casks here to age. We ended up with some pretty good stuff. We weren't really supposed to drink it, but every so often we would cheat a little. Corlandon got the stopper out without incident and decanted the wine into a blown quartz laboratory flask, and from there served it out into the thimbles. The first of these was passed to me, but I knew better than to drink from it right away. Everyone at the table had to get one. Last of all, Fra Corlandon, who raised his, looked me in the eye, and said, "To Fra Erasmus, on the occasion of his freedom, long may it last, richly may he enjoy it, wisely may he use it." Then, clinking all around, I was uneasy about the "wisely may he use it" part, but I drank anyway. The stuff was tremendous. Like drinking your favorite book. The others had all stood for the toast. Now they sat down, allowing me to see the rest of the refectory. Some tables were watching the toast and hoisting tankards of whatever they were drinking. Others were involved in their own conversations. Standing around the edges of the place, mostly alone, were the ones I most wanted to talk to. Orlo, Jessery, Tullia, and Haligastrim. Dinner became quite long and not very ascetic. They kept refilling my glass. I felt very well taken care of.
"Someone get him to his palate," I heard a Fra saying. "He's finished."
Hands were under my arms, helping me to my feet. I let them escort me as far as the cloister before I shook them off. My time in the minster had made me well aware of which parts of the consent could not be seen from the warden regulant's windows. I made several orbits around the cloister just to clear my head, and then went into the garden and sat down on a bench that was shielded from view. "Are you even a sentient being at this point, or should I wait until the morning?" a voice asked. I looked over to discover that Tullia had joined me. I was pretty sure she had woken me up.
"Please,"
I said, and patted the bench next to me. Tullia sat down but kept her distance, the better to get a thigh up on the bench and turn sideways to face me. "I'm glad you're out," she said. "A lot has been going on."
"So I gathered," I said. "Is there any way to sum it up quickly?"
"Something's funny with Orlo. No one knows what."
"Oh, come on, the Starhenge has been locked. What else is there to know?"
"That's obvious," she said,
a little bit annoyed at my tone.
"But no one knows why. We think Orlo knows, but he's not telling."
"Okay, sorry."
"It has been shaping Eliger. Some Fids who were expected to join the Edharians have gone to other orders."
"I noticed that. Why? What's the logic?"
"I'm not so sure it is logical. Until Appert, all the Fids knew exactly what they wanted to do. Then so many things happen at once. Your penance, the Inquisitors, the closure of the Starhenge, Fra Paflagon's evocation. It shook people up, made them rethink it.
Rethink it how?
It got everyone thinking politically. They made decisions they might not have done otherwise. For one thing, it cast doubt on the wisdom of joining the Edharians.
You mean because they are on the outs politically?
They're always on the outs politically. But seeing what happened to you, people got to thinking that it was unwise to turn one's back on that side of the consent.
I'm starting to get it, I said. So a guy like Arcibald, by going to the reformed old Fanians who want him desperately,
can become important in the reformed old Fanians right away.
I noticed he was serving the main course at supper.
That was an honor normally reserved for senior fras. He could become the FAE or a hierarch, maybe even primate, and he could fight some of the idiotic things that have been going on lately.
So the ones who have been going to the Edharians
are the best of the best.
Like Jesri.
Exactly.
We're going to screen you Edharians, protect you on the political front so that you can be free to do what you do best, I said.
That's the gist of it. But who's this you and we you're talking about?
Clearly where this is going is that tomorrow you join the Edharians and I join the new circle.
That's what everyone expects. It's not what is going to happen, Raz.